Hello and welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Author of the Week. And today I'm welcoming back an author who last time we met was promoting a book about Nancy Mitzvah's lover. But today we're talking about her second book in a series of thrillers. I'm talking to L.S. Hilton about her second book starring her heroine, Judith Rashley. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
Dominar.
Awesome.
Hi, Lisa.
Hello,
welcome back to Radio Gorgeous.
It's great to be with you.
So it seems many moons ago we met, and since then you've become a best-selling author. You sold the film rights to Maestra, and now you're becoming quite famous for your erotic thrillers. How's it going?
Gosh, I don't feel in the least bit famous. It's all been very surprising, really. I still think of myself primarily as an historian. As you remember, the book I was talking about last time with you was a biography, a joint biography of Nancy Mitford and Gaston Perlevsky. And I still really feel that that's my actual job. Maestra was a book I wrote very much to please myself. And at first, no one wanted it at all. I couldn't persuade my regular publisher or my then agent to even look at it. So everything that's happened since is enormously surprising, really.
Well, that's wonderful. It's nothing like a surprise. Now, let's talk about Judith first. I was fascinated by her. Sorry, I've not read Maestra, but it didn't seem to matter at all. What I found most fascinating about Judith was her humble beginnings. Can you tell us about Judith's upbringing?
Certainly. Judith Rashley comes from a very impoverished and indeed rather unhappy background, more than unhappy. Her mother's an alcoholic. They have very, very little money. She's forced to grow up and pretty much look after herself very quickly. And this background is one of the things that really fuels her ambition, first to go to university, then to get a job in an auction house. I suppose that the underlying theme of both Maestra and Domina is a kind of satire on meritocracy, that actually, you know, running hard and working as best you can and believing in yourself sometimes just isn't enough. Sometimes you have to resort to other measures, and that's very much what Judith does. But as we discover in volume two of the series, in Domina, there's a dark secret in her past which also provides some of her motivations.
Judith's mother, yeah, was an alky. She grew up no boundaries and had massive responsibility. Now as an adult, she breaks all the rules and is very motivated to get what she wants. So you're saying it is definitely related to her upbringing then?
One of the things I was trying to do in the second book was to flesh out Judith's background a bit more. In Maestra, in number one, we know very little about her. She kind of emerges fully formed. And so I wanted to give readers who were returning to the book the chance to get to know the character better. I think she does have a lack of boundaries, but in contrast with the first book, Domina is really about the fact that she's trying to stop. She really doesn't want to do this anymore. And yet the circumstances in which she finds herself, the fact that her past has caught up with her, kind of obliges her to carry on being the well-dressed serial killer we all know and love.
So the world of Judith, she represents this ultra-glamorous, super-rich, high society. She dresses top-to-toe designer clothes and is dazzling sophisticated. How much fun is it researching that lifestyle?
Oh, it's huge. It's huge fun. I'm so glad that you like that part of the book, because it's not meant to be, a harrowing work of social realism. It is meant to be, you know, a bit glitzy, a bit shiny. Mm-hmm. I really loved those sort of 70s and 80s bonkbusters like Lace when I was a teenager. I love that sense of being transported into another more glamorous world. I love the sort of exciting, aspirational aspect of those books. And I wanted to give something of that sheer pleasure to Judith. A lot of critics have sort of complained that there are too many designer labels in the books, but a lot of readers seem to really love it.
And, oh, I loved it.
And I also think it's something that particularly women readers may identify with, because whenever I imagine myself in any situation, my first thought is, what am I going to wear? And I think it's really important to know exactly what the character's wearing at any given time. The research part, yeah, I did a bit of I wangled myself a few invitations. So part of the book, I researched in Ibiza, and I got to spend time
That's very glamorous.
Some pretty glitzy parties.
Yeah.
But I also wanted to show that there is a much seedier underside to these apparently sort of glamorous environments. So we do see, yes, Judith going to the amazing houses in Ibiza, but we also see her being horrified by the way that the men behave towards the women who are staying there. We see her, at, you know, at the Louis Vuitton Foundation in Paris going to a glamorous art party, but we also see her in a dingy sex club in Belleville. I wanted to contrast all that bright, sparkly stuff with a bit more kind of grit.
Yeah, which is reality, absolutely. Nearly every man, she's so lucky, she meets wants to go to bed with her. She uses her sexuality. The first scene is totally outrageous. And I want to ask, do you read erotic stories yourself? And by the way, I did ask my partner to try the flat tongue technique in cunnilingus. Oh my God, it really works.
Please just say that again to all your listeners. Oh my God, it really works. Doesn't it just? You see, who said that, you know, reading dirty novels wasn't good for you? I'm so distracted now. I've completely.
No, but how did you learn that one? How did you learn the flat tongue?
Oh, that was from a French boy many, many years ago. French men are very good at good at oral sex. I have been a great reader of erotic novels. A big fan of the classics. Pauline Réage, obviously. Histoire Vaux has to be my favourite one. I'm a huge fan of Aline Rey's Le Boucher. I'm trying to think what I read recently that I thought was really sexy. Actually, I worked recently on a theatre production of Les Liaisons Dangereuses at the Dormoir Warehouse. I was the historical advisor on it, and I'd forgotten what an incredibly erotic novel that is. I mean, there's no explicit scenes in it, obviously, but the psychological tension and the conflict between the characters is so highly charged, it kind of fizzes off the page at you. Mm. I think explicit and erotic are often not the same thing. Mm. I also didn't at all set out to write an erotic book. When I was writing Maestro, I wanted to write in what I thought was an honest, candid and realistic way about sex. And sex is very much part of Judith's personality, but it also moves the plot forward. The people she encounters and seeks out during her sexual liaisons actually move the plot forward. So I was quite surprised when people said it was an erotic novel. I didn't intend it to be.
I suppose, yeah, when you look at things like the Shirley Conran books, people would never have called it erotic then, even though she's got erotic scenes in
that
it.
That scene with the goldfish. Did you ever forget, speaking of cunnilingus, never the scene with the hapless goldfish? Yeah. Now, they didn't describe it as erotic, although they were actually very, very sexually explicit, those books.
Probably maybe because the word erotic wasn't so... Now it's so in, isn't it?
Well, now it's so fashionable. And I think there was... it was perhaps a lot more... Erotica was a lot more sort of looked down upon. It wasn't seen as a mainstream genre in the way it is now. But no, I never really intended to write a sexy book, although I'm very glad that people find it sexy.
It really is. So Judith, an intelligent seducer, she uses her sex to attract women and men. Was she bi in the last book?
Yes, she was. There was a lovely scene where she did a double dip involving a pair of handcuffs, a prostitute called Hélène, and a boy named Stanley. So, very much so, yes.
So, is that kind of part... Was that always going to be a part of her persona?
It just made sense to me. Again, I mean, Judith is considerably younger than I am. She's part of a different generation, and I think the attitudes towards sexuality are much more relaxed, much more fluid, much less binary than they were when I was growing up. And so it seemed very natural to me that Judith's erotic drive would be towards both sexes. I think she probably has a preference for men. I've given her more male partners.
Do you think she'd allow herself to fall in love?
Love's not really an option for her. It's not something which is conceptually available to her. Although I think she is quite a nice person. She's quite nice to her friends. She does have her own rather peculiar code of ethics, if that's possible to apply to a sociopathic murderer. But she does have loyalty, and she does feel some emotion. She just can't quite understand that in other people.
Okay, sorry, on to the next page.
It adds to the veracity.
Yeah.
I can hear you turning the page there.
As the book goes on, because it begins and she is another personality, her mask literally slips, as well as her identity, and she becomes more earthy and human. And as it goes on, the humour kind of evolves, I really found.
I'm really glad. I think, in many ways, Domino is a much darker book than Maestro, but I think it's also much funnier. Maestro was about Judith getting to the top. It was about her getting everything that she wanted. And what I wanted to do with Domino was to systematically strip that away. So I take away her money, I take away her clothes, I take away her gallery, I take away even her sex drive. And most importantly, I take away her self-confidence, her belief in herself. Because I firstly wanted to, I think it's very important that characters evolve, otherwise it's very boring for both reader and writer. But also, I wanted readers to get closer to the elements of Judith's personality, to see that she's not just a cipher, she is a fully rounded character. And because it's a trilogy, which I've conceived of very much as a single story, the second book is kind of the slow movement mm-hmm. before the crescendo at the end.
Great. So I must ask, how much of Judith is you? I mean, come on, everyone must ask that, Lisa.
Yes.
I mean, it must be some sort of fantasy side, you know.
I've spent quite a lot of time with Judith in the last couple of years, because obviously writing the books, but also then I'm spending so much time in so many places talking about them. I feel I know her very well. Rather unnervingly, I wouldn't say she's become an alter ego, but I might go so far as to say she's my imaginary best friend. We have some things in common. I mean, our birthplace, Liverpool, history of art, shoes, I guess we have in common.
Does she look like you?
We don't know what she looks like, do we?
Yeah, no.
I never describe
her. Do you know?
I have no idea what she looks like.
Wow.
A really interesting thing happened, actually. I was doing a talk in New York, and I asked the audience, what does Judith look like? And about five people put their hands up, and they all told me something different. And I said, well, actually, no. I'm thrilled that you have such a vivid picture of her in your heads, but there is no description. And then these readers started contradicting me and saying, no, but in trying to find the bit in the book where I describe her, and I don't. I didn't want to be prescriptive. I didn't want any reader, male or female, to have an idea that she had to be a certain way. I think the fact that we don't know what she looks like makes her scarier as well.
Yes, because then she's a mystery.
I have no idea what she looks like. I know what she sounds like. That's all.
And she's also got quite a good figure if she can wear all those clothes.
I imagine her as slim, but also quite athletic, because she has to be strong for a lot of the stuff that she gets up to.
Yes, yeah, the positions.
All sorts of things. Oh, speaking of the positions, you know, yeah. I was really cross. I don't normally read my reviews, but I read a review in The Independent of Domino, and it said that the sex scene in which she, the Serbian gangster, gives her oral sex whilst holding her above his head is completely ludicrous. Now, I object to that, because that is based upon research. And it takes a strong man to do it, but it can be done.
Fantastic.
So I object to
You've got to write in. Anyway, you're airing it now on Radio Gorgeous. So
everyone's going to know. Everyone's going to know now.
Also, there are references to a lot of thriller writers in Domino, so I'm sure you must read those as well.
I love a good thriller. I really love a good thriller, especially on a journey, a train journey or a plane, something that you really want to find out what's happening, keep turning the pages. I love that. I mean, the classics, people like Chandler. I'm quite a big fan of Scandi fictions, sort of Scandi noir. And recently I've been reading Delphine de Vigan's fantastically good, based on a true story, which isn't a thriller. It's a sort of intellectual French take on a thriller, but it's wonderfully chilling and a real page turner. So yeah, but again, it's also quite playful. I think there is an awareness of the genre in Judith's character. I mean, Judith is a reader. She's always carries a book with her, and she makes references to the writers she loves. And she also kind of slightly sends herself up. There is one little naughty joke in this book as well, because, unfortunately, my Maestro was compared to 50 Shades of Grey. And it is nothing like 50 Shades of Grey. But there is a bit right at the end where a male prostitute's describing his John as wanting a bit of Christian Grey action. So there was a little joke in there.
Yeah, exactly. Perfect. So I think people are more threatened by a lawless woman than a man. Why do you think that is? And it is true. Because they project everything?
I think that's absolutely true. And I think it's very interesting in literature, the way that male and female characters are judged. Women are only allowed to be bad if they're traumatised and or if they get punished. And if you write about a bad woman, somehow it means you're not a feminist. I don't know whether anyone would accuse William Thackeray of not being a feminist for creating Becky Sharp, but I think there is something anarchic about a violent or lawless woman. I think we're still sort of culturally bred with the idea that, you know, men are capable of violence. We associate men with violence. We are protected by men who commit violence. If one thinks about soldiers, it's a much more natural association. It's something we see reinforced all the time in films. So the idea of a woman crossing those boundaries is quite threatening. I think if one thinks, for example, of, I mean, it's a dreadful case, but if one thinks of the way that Myra Hindley was vilified for so many years, and of course what she did was utterly appalling, but compared with the number of, you know, male child killers who exist, I mean, she was very much an anomaly, and yet it almost seemed as though all the opprobrium and loathing of the past sort of 30 years was directed towards her. And I think it's because, you know, a violent woman, a lawless woman is so transgressive, it terrifies us.
Which
is, of course, why it's interesting.
Now, lastly, I've got to say I'm intrigued that you're a librettist. Can you explain what one is and what you do?
It means that you write the words for operas.
Fabulous.
And I wouldn't, any more than I describe myself as an erotic writer, I collaborated on my first opera last year, which was, it's called Love Hurts, and it's about the Marquis de Sade, which is a cheap gag, although actually it's quite a serious piece. It's set in the lunatic asylum at Charenton, and it's about de Sade's obsession with a medieval serial killer. Are we seeing a theme here? Gilles de Rais. And it was premiered in Milan last June, and then it went to Broadway, which was pretty exciting. And yeah, hopefully next year I will be writing another one.
So tell us about, is it like writing lyrics, or is it more of a story, you know?
It's very, very different to anything I've attempted before. It's not really like writing poetry or lyrics. You have to be extraordinarily concise. And obviously you have to pay attention to the score, so you have to, the rhythm of your words has to fit with the score very closely.
So do you listen to the music while you're doing it?
No, I wrote it by reading the score on one side, and then...
So you can read music?
I can read music.
Okay.
Badly. No, I think maybe you kind of have to be able to.
Yeah.
And it's... I suppose if it's similar to anything, it's almost like trying to compose haiku. You've got to convey an enormous amount of dramatic information in a very small space. You really don't have any words. I found it really, really engaging, and very much enjoyed doing it.
And did you see the performance?
I saw both. In Milan and in New York. Although in New York, the soprano forgot her words on the first night, and she was bravely carrying on. I was thinking, did I write this? So the singers sometimes do have a tendency to kind of, yes, make things up if they forget their words, but I think that's probably part of the experience.
Oh, wonderful. So you must be working on the third one.
Oh, I am working on the third one. I've got to give it in really soon, which is a bit terrifying, and the third one, which is called Ultima, is going to be out with Bonnier next spring.
And come on, tell us a little teaser.
Well, it starts with quite a dramatic scene involving a mafioso and a hairpin.
In Calabria.
Yeah. The hairpin's very important. Mm-hmm. And put it this way, I think Judith's back with a vengeance in volume three.
Oh, thank you so much, Lisa, for coming on to onto Radio Gorgeous.
Huge pleasure. Thank you very much.
Domino is out now and written by L.S. Hilton, published by
Bonnier Zaffrey.
Yes. And can I just ask, do you speak fluent French?
I do.
Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous.